So, today, it's my pleasure to introduce to you our animateur, Elizabeth Panasiuk, whom I haven't seen for quite a few years. She was, and still is, gather, a student in my department of the university, the philosophy department. She came to us with an MA in philosophy from Waterloo, and she continues to work on a doctoral dissertation on global justice. But in the meantime, most of her time is taken up doing sort of slave labor teaching for Graham McEwen University in their philosophy program, teaching a very wide variety of courses. And she tells me that she's teaching three courses each term, which is an unbelievable load. So I'm very grateful that she has taken time out to come and lead this session for us. And it's going, the official title of it is You Can't Have All of Me, But Can I Sell You a Part? And the topic is really whether body parts are proper objects to become commodities in the market. Okay. So I think everybody here knows the schedule. We usually go to 2:15, 2:30, take a break for 15 or 20 minutes, and come back for a finish up discussion. Elizabeth will sort of get things started with a little 15, 20 minute talk, and then it's of course over to you with questions and expressions of your points of view and your thoughts on the subject. Elizabeth.
Is this good? Good volume?
Yeah.
Just want to thank Martin for inviting me and Don Carmichael too for inviting me as well. My role is simply just to get the discussion going by bringing in these issues. And this was a wonderful opportunity to actually read Sandel's book, which I hadn't done until Martin called me, and to learn actually about organ trafficking, which I knew nothing about as well. So here are the things that I thought were particularly interesting from Sandel's book. So Sandel tells us that markets have invaded pretty much every aspect of our lives, right? We can buy apologies, or somebody can apologize for us if we're uncomfortable to do so. For $150, if you're too busy, you can get somebody to write you a very personalized and heartfelt toast for your best friend's wedding, right? We can pay people to stand in line for us if we're busy, right? And what's interesting about all this is that markets are no longer just about an efficient distribution of material goods, right? They are now in education, in healthcare, all sorts of social goods. There are some things that we seem to all agree on should not be commodified. And one of them is we don't sell people. We don't sell whole people, and we don't sell children. We're also, you know, quite squeamish about selling votes. And the rationale seems to be why there's this large consensus where we're not selling these things is if we start to sell these things, it starts to degrade them, right? There's something kind of morally icky about starting to sell humans, votes, etc. They're completely off the table, right? It will create some kind of corrosive effect, not only when it comes to those actual goods, but also to the norms and practices around those particular goods. So some things we've agreed are completely off the table. Other things, not so clear. Right. So, and the issue I want to raise today, and I think the title is fantastic, is there something wrong with buying and selling body parts. We've all agreed that we can't sell whole people. That's nice. But why can't I sell part of me? Why, if I was a poor student and wanted to make some extra money, why couldn't I go in and sell my blood if I wanted to buy my mother a very nice present? Why couldn't I do this? Why, if I had a child who was dying because they needed a kidney transplant and I had the money, why couldn't I go and purchase a kidney instead of waiting for my child to die as he waits for years and years on organ transplant list? Should we allow these kinds of practices? This is what we're going to talk about today. So, much of the real sort of controversial debate, I think, focuses on buying and selling of organs, because that's pretty much universally illegal, aside from Iran. And I'm not sure what's happening in Iran, to be honest. But I know Iran, there you can buy and sell organs there. But every place else, completely off the table, right? How do we get organs, right? Like kidneys, etc. We get them through voluntary donations. Various ways of doing this. One thing we do sometimes is sign our organ donor cards. Countries in Europe, like Germany, Spain, they have an implied consent policy where they assume you're going to be an organ donor and you have to actually opt out of that. You have to say, oh, actually, no, thank you. So there's various ways that we try to get voluntary donations. Yet, this is a subject for debate because there's an enormous shortage. Right? Thousands of people die every year waiting on an organ transplant list. Thousands, right? Shortage, not enough supply. And when we ask whether or not we should be able to commodify these goods and sell them, you have to keep in mind that these aren't just goods. These are life-saving goods. Right? These actually, whether or not we sell them or not, could mean somebody gets to live and somebody gets to die. So, not surprisingly, many people are advocating in favor of some kind of international legalized system where we can market organs. Right? So I'm not talking about selling organs in some sort of, you know, dark black market. We'll talk about black markets in it later on. But I'm talking about, should we actually legalize this practice and make organs available for as many people as possible? Organs, we don't like to sell those things. But there's body parts that are much less controversial, right? So, for example, take the United States. Right? You can't sell your organs in the United States, but you can sell many parts of you in the United States. You can sell your blood, plasma, and platelets. You can sell your sperm. You can sell your eggs. You can rent out your womb. You can sell your hair. Right? All of these sorts of things, perfectly legal. In contrast, let's look at Canada, just because we live here. So in Canada, right, it's always been illegal to sell blood, as far as I know. But interestingly, just in 2013, in February, what happened was the newspaper article popped up saying two plasma centers opened up in Canada where you could now start to sell your plasma, one in Winnipeg and one in Toronto. I think it was the first of its kind. And what do? They will pay you for your plasma, and they sell it to Blood Services Canada, right? And this is all sanctioned by Health Canada. And one story for why this is happening is because health, apparently about 70% of the plasma that Blood Services already has is purchased from the United States. It's purchased from the United States, and where people get paid to give, right? This is the story, according to the Church of Google, who I pray to. So in Canada, I don't know whether it's the demand for plasma products is so great, or we just don't offer enough incentives for us to keep up with our own, that we have to outsource and buy plasma from the U.S. What about other body parts in Canada? Am I okay in volume? I know. Yeah? Other body parts in Canada. We can't sell eggs. We can't sell sperm. You can't get paid for surrogacy in Canada. These things were outlawed in 2004 when they sort of redid our reproductive shenanigans legally, right? And there is, there's, in a sense, outlawing all these things kind of takes the stand that reproductive materials are not to be commodified. And I think that one question that's really interesting, and we can discuss that later, is there an important moral difference between saying it's okay to sell some parts of you, but not other parts of you? Right? So people might make the case, well, like things like blood or sperm, they're renewable, whereas kidneys, you got two, right? But is there something that's much more kind of schizophrenic about taking a position where it's okay to sell certain body parts and not others? And I think the answer to that might hinge on how our one of Sandel's reasons for being squeamish about the whole selling of any kind of body part. So let's look at some arguments. I'm a philosopher, we like arguments. So what are some arguments in favor of selling, being able to sell our parts? I want to talk about two general arguments. One is a basic argument that we own our bodies. Why shouldn't I be allowed to do what I want with my body? Classic argument. It's been made for the right to for abortions, all sorts of things, right? I can pierce my ears, I can get a tattoo, I can do all of these sorts of things if I wish, right? Why shouldn't I be able to go and sell a kidney, right? Sell my eggs, sell whatever I want. Don't I have a right to sell what's mine? So that's one line of reasoning in favor. Another line of reasoning in favor is what I want to just call utilitarian, sort on utilitarian grounds, right? A general argument that promoting and allowing the sale of bodily parts increases well-being and social welfare for everyone. In what way? A few, right? One, supplies are low for organs, right? Supplies are really low. You're essentially going to save lives if you give certain monetary incentives or allow people to sell these things, that lives that wouldn't normally be saved. People who are offering to give their organs for a fee, they get money, it's a consensual transaction, they are better off. Right? More people live, more people get money for their organs, everything's good. Here's another issue. Right? People have argued too that financially it's just cheaper. Right? To keep somebody on dialysis, the Google tells me, is about $30,000 a month. $30,000 a month. Now, if you have a state paying these kinds of health care costs, perhaps it's much more prudent and efficient for the state to get involved in some kind of legalized organ market, right? Finally, and a lot of people especially focus on this argument, if we legalize the sale of body parts like organs, you're going to eliminate a lot of harms that come from black market practices, right? So people still buy organs, even though it's not legalized. Apparently it's not that big of a practice, but it's happening. And what are the consequences of it being sort of an underground market? Many, right? Many harms happen because you have situations where you might have there's no quality control on the organs, there's no quality control on the kinds of surgery and the kinds of postoperative care that you get. Certain people are not given full explanations, right? Poor people come and organ traffickers give them some sort of sketchy story. They say that sounds good because they're in dire straits, and they don't understand the full story of what's about to happen to them and the consequences of it. A lot of people don't get full compensation for the organs that they have donated, and the trafficker takes most of them. There's also just theft of organs, right? People are killed and organs are harvested, right? Because there's a black market. So the point of all of this is that what's happening, or that if we legalize it, we eliminate these harms, right? We eliminate these harms. If this practice is going to happen anyway, we eliminate these kinds of harms. So all of those points point to utilitarian considerations. Legalizing it is actually going to promote general good, welfare, minimize suffering, more happiness, etc. So those are the two general sorts of reasons, I think, that are given for why it's a good idea to legalize organ sales. In terms of why we shouldn't, I want to draw on the kinds of things that Sandel raises. The first issue is issues of inequality and fairness. Right. So kidney markets, organ markets in general, they usually prey upon the poor. And to decide, some might argue, in a fairly coercive situation where the coercion is essentially financial necessity, they decide to engage and give up one of their organs, but it's not a practice that they would normally choose. So you also end up with all these sorts of worries where if we legalize the organ market, are we going to essentially end up with people in poor countries supplying the people in wealthy countries with life-saving organs that they themselves wouldn't be able to get if they need their own lives saved, right? Further entrenching inequalities, unfairness, all of these issues, right? Issues of what counts as coercion, whether you can actually make a free choice when you're in financial dire straits. All of these fall under these considerations of fairness and equality, and Sandel raises these. But the most interesting sort of point that he makes is, imagine a country where there's no poverty. Right? Everything's nice, happy, good. Is there still any moral qualms that you feel about selling body parts and selling organs? If we eliminate all issues of fairness and equality, no questions about coercion, no questions about rich and poor. If you eliminate that, is there still a moral qualm you feel about selling body parts? Sandel, I think, does, right? And the second argument against commodifying and selling our parts in this way hinges on what he describes as it will result in the corruption and degradation of these goods and how we respond to these goods in a way. So what does it mean to corrupt or degrade a good, right? So for instance, remember how I mentioned that now you can, this is Sandel's example, now you can buy a really heartfelt, beautiful, personalized speech that you can give at a wedding for your best friend, right? Wonderful. $150, great bargain if you're very busy. So wouldn't it corrupt, wouldn't it somehow be corrupt that speech that was given, degrade it in some way, if you found out that your best friend who gave you that most heartfelt speech or that letter that you wrote that just moved you, if you found out that somebody bought it? You would. You should. So this is what Sandel's talking about when he's talking about it corrupts or degrades these kinds of goods, right? So when it comes to selling body parts, kidneys, etc., right? Sandel suggests we have to ask the question whether it promotes a certain degraded notion of the human being, right? As essentially a collection of spare parts to be bought and sold, even if we are willing to do so. He suggests that perhaps some uses of our own bodies, even if we're freely doing it, count as acts of self-degradation. Right? Self-degradation. So some people make this argument when it comes to sex workers, right? So even if the sex worker is, you know, comes from a very sort of wealthy background, enjoys the work, etc., right? There's no issues of coercion or anything of that sort. Some people still want to make the argument that that's not the proper way to treat a body, right? That there is a certain act of sort of self-degradation. And so this is Sandel's sort of trajectory when he makes his second, when he articulates his second issue with selling our body parts. So, related to this is the idea of, are we, right, going to erode certain kind of social norms that we want to preserve if we start to commodify and sell these bits and pieces of us? And Sandel argues that it might. Okay? What kinds of norms are these? Norms, essentially, of we can couch them as norms of civic responsibility, right, solidarity, and seeing our organ shortages and health, right, as a collective problem that requires a collective solution, rather than seeing it as something to be fixed by individual market transactions. So when we start to actually pay for something that we feel should have some sort of intrinsic motivation, it changes that very thing, Sandel argues, right? So he offers various examples of how these are changed. When you offer actual monetary incentives for things that used to be given as free gifts. And he's got several of them, and I'm happy to give you more after, but just to be on point, one example he gives is the study by Titmus. And Titmus studied blood donations in the U.S., and he discovered that there was a decline in voluntary blood donation as soon as people started to get paid for giving blood. Titmus's argument is that this is because it changed the nature of the good, right? Markets aren't neutral. They can change the nature of things. And it changed the nature of the good, turned blood into a commodity, and this eroded people's obligation to freely give the blood. The interesting, and what the more interesting point, I think, is that Titmus also says that if you start to erode these kinds of altruistic sort of virtues in one domain, it just doesn't stick with that domain, right? It's going to spread to every other domain. It's not going to be an erosion of civic responsibility just with respect to donating blood, but we're going to be losing, right, those civic impulses in all sorts of domains. Sandel agrees. Right? He thinks altruism, benevolence, these kinds of virtues need to be exercised, or else they atrophy and die. So, a market, right, a completely market system that's going to rely solely on self motivations of self-interest, right, completely displaces all those other kinds of motivations, he says, that he thinks we ought to be cultivating. So, I think, right, that there's an interesting question about whether Sandel's right here, actually, right? When it comes to altruism, generosity, all of that stuff, is it really a matter of the more we do, right, the more that we want to do and engage in? Or do we actually run out of goodwill? No, seriously, do we, right? Compassion fatigue, right? People calling you, asking you to do this for them, this for them, this for them. Do we run out of goodwill? Is Sandel just being a little too optimistic? And one of the critics of Titmus's study, the blood donation study, actually made the point saying, look, altruism and all of these civic virtues, they're all really nice. They're great. But they are fragile. And they can be depleted very easily. And so he argued that we should let the market do all the things that a market can do, because we never run out of self-interest, right? All you need in market, you never run out of self-interest. But do we run out of goodwill? And the criticism is we should save, right? We should actually save the altruism that we do have, the goodwill, the ability to do good for others, for those things that the market can't actually solve. And let the market do the rest, right? We never run out of self-interest. Now, I found one sort of interesting thing that happened in Canada that might speak to that. Sperm, yeah. So in Canada, right, when sperm was outlawed in 2004, 40 sperm banks closed, right? So you couldn't sell sperm. But they still wanted sperm. But as soon as they stopped paying for it, 40 sperm banks had to close. Why? Nobody was donating anymore. Financial incentives were the only reason for the supply. And apparently, in Canada currently, I just think this is interesting, there's only about 35 active sperm donors in Canada. 35. Like, but as many as in this room. That's it. So there's a lot of, like, half-brothers and sisters everywhere. Anyways. Where's it? So where are we getting our sperm? From the U.S., where they're paying people. That's where we're getting most of our sperm, where they're paying people. Right? So this is interesting because it's what is actually incentivizing people is monetary payment here. Right? People aren't like, oh, I feel altruistic today, I must go donate sperm. That doesn't happen. Right? I faint every time I give blood, so I stop because I'm tired of fainting. I could go and faint again, but I don't want to. Mm-hmm. I'm lazy. So, although I think a really good case can be made using various sorts of examples that were given, that if you provide financial incentives, right, these external motivations, you often do get an increase in supply, right, of whatever it is that you're losing, whether it's organs, right, blood, sperm, etc. You do get an increase in supply. But what Sandel's point is it's at a cost. And that cost is, he claims, an erosion of certain kinds of values, civic values, altruism, right, solidarity, willing to work together for the common good, right, by freely offering these sorts of gifts in our sort of way. So, which of these values is more important? Three questions that I'm going to leave you with, and then you guys can talk. One, obviously, the first one is, where do you stand on the sale of body parts, right? And does it matter at all to you what part we are talking about? Right? Do you think that there is something schizophrenic about a system like the U.S. that says, yeah, no, you can totally sell your eggs, your blood, but don't you dare sell a kidney. That's wrong. Is there something schizophrenic about it? Two, right, I think issues surrounding inequality and fairness when it comes to organ markets and things of that sort are uncontroversial. They're going to arise. Why? Issues of inequality and fairness arise anytime you talk about markets. Any markets. So it's going to happen when we're talking about body parts as well. Who gets access? Who can afford? All of these sorts of things. What I think is a more sort of interesting objection that Sandel makes is this idea that beyond this issue of fairness and equality, right, is there something morally objectionable to commodifying and selling pieces of yourself, right? Does the value that that brings, and we talked about what those values could be, right? Life, right? It saves lives. It provides more people, it incentivizes more people to go and give a lot of the time. Although he's got also some interesting examples that suggest that may not be the case other times. So we get that, but at what cost? And the cost is a certain kind of understanding of what the human being is, how we understand the body, and an erosion of what he says are certain kinds of practices that go along with health, right? How we understand the body, civic solidarity, altruism, all of these sorts of things that we're supposed to freely do because we care about the other people, that we feel some sort of obligation or responsibility toward them. He argues that these are going to get eroded if we start to replace these kinds of norms with market norms, external incentives, right? Paying people or body parts, getting money for them. So that's all I want to say, and I'm interested in your opinion on that. Any of those things?
All right, is this working? Yes, good. So put your thoughts together, and who would like to start off with either a question or an opinion?
Yeah. Well, a question for Elizabeth. I just wonder, would it help to... Yeah, don't sit down. We're not done with you yet. Uh-huh. Wonderful presentation.
Oh, thank you, Don.
Wonderful. So I want... Now I'm wondering, would it help to distinguish between, as you did earlier on, between, say, life essential body parts and inessential? Like, I mean, I actually was stunned to hear that there people want to buy sperm. Really, but I don't see any problem with people buying and selling hair, for example, or you know stuff like that. But organs or life essential organs, is that a distinction that's helpful for you?
For me, is it a distinction? I think that if you take some kind of utilitarian approach to it, right, to sort of say, oh, well, these are sort of renewable resources. I can always get more blood, sperm, grow my hair, etc. The cost to me is less significant. The danger in terms of harms is less significant to me or everybody else who's engaging in these kinds of practices, where when it comes to vital organs, right, like kidneys or something of this sort, the harms are much more serious. They're non-renewable. You have one spare. And so on utilitarian grounds, I think that it makes a difference there. And maybe that's why people want to distinguish them, because we often employ that kind of reasoning morally. But I'm not sure if I adopted Sandel's mentality and adopted that idea about, if I commodify one body part, right, it's a commodification of any body part. It's the same thing, right? If it's this idea about certain things are just sacred and shouldn't be commodified and sold, body parts being one of them, because of what it does to this idea that these things should be voluntarily donated, that they're part of a collective good, they're part of a collective problem, that human body shouldn't be seen as part compartmentalized bits to be sold off, then I think it's a bit schizophrenic to select some and select others. So I think it depends on how you're thinking morally about this question. If you're more utilitarian in this, I think that there's a good justification for making distinctions between why we should allow some and why we shouldn't allow others on the basis of harms. When it comes to the other argument, I don't know whether you can justify why you should select some parts and not others.
You spoke of goodwill as being somewhat of a finite commodity. Now, is this in terms of individual goodwills or societal goodwills, or is the latter just the sum of the former? I speak for myself, and then after about 116 donations, I stopped giving blood when it became longer to go through the qualification process than to actually give your pint.
Yeah.
And I personally ran out of goodwill for that particular place. So is societal goodwill just the sum of individuals, or is there some larger beast there as well?
I don't know. I think ultimately you have to ultimately I don't think you have a societal goodwill unless you have a collection of individual sort of goodwills, right? And if individuals are walking around feeling completely depleted, right? And we can be depleted in all sorts of ways, right? We don't have time to be nice or generous or good or anything of that sort. Or even if we're still happy to do so, right? The whole world is full of suffering. There's tons of places that are asking for our attention, right? Donate here, come volunteer here, do this here, give up your blood, don't forget to fill your organ donor card, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, go visit your friends in the hospital, right? We run out of time, we run out of all these sorts of things. Right? But Sandel thinks, right, that the depletion argument doesn't actually have that much cachet. And I'm actually interested in what you think about that, because I think it's a really curious point, because a lot of it hinges on this idea of, can we just still rely on our voluntary goodwill to supply these life-giving gifts, right? Or do we need incentives? Like, hey, pay me for this. Right? If it's not enough for us to do this voluntarily, right? The costs are quite high. So I'm not sure. I don't know. I'd have to look at some altruism studies to see how rampant this kind of compassion fatigue actually is. Right? One of my favorite studies, I shouldn't start this because I don't know if I can finish it well, but one of my favorite studies is about priests who are studying Good Samaritan. It was a Princeton study, and they had groups of priests, and they were studying the Good Samaritan all day, and they told the priest that, hey, you have to give a talk across campus, and half the priests, they told, or the seminary students, they told, you're late, and half of them, they told, you have lots of time to get there. And they put a person on the path as they're walking who's like, oh, help me, or whatever, right? Like, so they were just primed to study, they were just primed studying this parable of the Good Samaritan. They put this person who needs their help right in front of them. And you'd think that a lot of priests would have stopped, but they didn't, especially the ones who were in the, hey, you're late. They didn't, because they were late. And this study really illustrates how I think it's interesting, maybe I don't know if it illustrates this, but it's interesting in saying how situational factors really can sort of undermine what we think are sort of deep character traits. And so I don't know how robust altruism really is. I think it's an interesting question. I'm interested in your thoughts on this. Yes, sir.
So I have two questions. One is it, could they both be right? We tend to want to say that it's either this or that, and maybe it's aspects of both. But
can you say more about how you see?
I think they both could be true. Like, I think that you could run out, you know.
Sometimes.
Okay. I think they both could be true. Like, I think there are elements in certain situations, and if you go too far this way, you could run out. If you go too far that way, you could. So they both, it might be striking the right balance. But is there a difference between altruism and civic responsibility? So this is a second question. Mm. So when I think of...
What do you think?
Well, I think of my kids.
Okay.
If I start paying them,
yeah,
then every time I ask them to do something, it'll be, well, what am I going to get paid for? Mm. And there's a certain responsibility that should be, it's not altruistic for you to help out.
Yes.
And there's sort of a civic responsibility. And so do we, instead of eroding altruism, do we maybe further erode a sense of civic responsibility to our country or to our society.
Yeah, and I think that Sandel argues that, right? So whether your motivations are more touchy-feely and altruistic or sentimental or compassionate, or I feel bad about all those poor people who need blood or something of this sort, or whether it's, no, this is the right thing to do. This is what a good person does. They go and they give blood, they sign their organ donor card, they do all these kinds of things. And I love your example that you give with your child, right? That even though they might help more, if you're incentivizing them through money, you might get more supply of help in your house, right? What you're sort of suggesting is what Sandel is suggesting, is that you are you're displacing in them their any sort of genuine desire to do these things because they're part of the family. They feel responsible to participate in the common good, even though they're not going to articulate that in their head, right? But you're displacing that one norm of, I'm part of a family, I should help. This is just what a kid does, help out with, I help out if I get some sort of incentive, right? And Sandel says this is, right, a value that I don't think he actually takes deliberate sort of stand on it in any way, but I don't think he doesn't seem to want to sort of give that up, right? And when we start to pay people for body parts, buy and sell them, we get into that situation.
Yeah, I think it's a nice distinction between altruism, that is just a sort of desire to help people out,
yeah,
and feeling an obligation to the community to join in a certain effort which will improve things for people.
I think
they're distinct things.
Along the same line, the other day on the radio they were talking about a study that was comparing the rich and the poor, mm-hmm, and it was very interesting because there they found that both in the case of, you know, what you would describe as altruistic and what you would describe as, you know, community-oriented or civic-minded, you know, these were definitely lacking on wherever they looked at people who were richer rather than poor.
Right. You mean that people who are of lower socioeconomic, they tend to give more, they tend to be more generous.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right, yeah. Yeah. Do you know the people around White Avenue or sometimes by the LRT stations who are asking you to sign up for things, right? Here, on a monthly basis, sign up for Amnesty or Oxfam or Save Some Animals or something. One of them once told me that the people who end up signing up for this most, and I don't know whether it's sort of location-based or whatever, it's like, they're like, wealthy people don't want to. He's like, they're like, students do. Students who, like, have no money are the ones who are doing this, right? Which is surprising, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, Astrid, I had just written that as one question.
Yeah, right up to your mouth.
All right, I had just noticed I heard the same study. So the lack of willingness to take the time or to help.
Yeah.
Was based on your income. It was so stunning.
Stunning.
So that seems to tie in with what they're saying.
In your view, or and I open that up to anybody. How do you explain that?
That when there's either when there's a monetary reason for them to be rushing. Like, their time is more important. You've mentioned time several times.
Mm-hmm.
Time is a commodity.
Mm-hmm.
We've commodified that.
Mm-hmm.
So that keeps playing into those decisions about how we make an altruistic decision.
Mm-hmm.
And that hasn't been factored in, I don't believe, in terms of the time issue.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't, it hits us more now, I believe, in our society than perhaps. Not that I'm agreeing with that, but I think that's an interesting part of it. I have one other thing. I think the ship has sailed on the whole making body parts a commodity, because we can buy an arm or a hand or a piece to help this inflate or that, it's already there, and then the whole robotics, let's make the human body a part, that is so on at the heels of all of this, that has to be factored in. And I don't know that we have the distance now to make this decision only on the altruistic, I'm afraid. Because there's a recent study that had people's eyes, a person who had ALS could actually use his irises to answer questions. Right. And they made this computer thing. And the scientists who developed this made it so that we could replicate it for $10 each, so that it wasn't only for those who were wealthy and a famous thinker who would then get someone to help him purchase this. So there is that distinction being made by some scientists, but still, we're already, I can just get another arm if I wanted one. So how does that work into this?
Let me think. Well, I think that, I mean, my first thought is that we've gotten spare body parts, whether it's getting screws put in to keep our our elbows together after an accident, or brace or whatever. That's been happening for a long time. Or leg or something like this. Something, sticking your femur back together after you have a bad ski trip. Those sorts of things have been happening for a long time, and people weren't at the, there was no sort of big controversy about this, right? It's just, let's put people back together again using technology, right? And I think that whether it's, oh, look, we can now get people who have no sort of movement to find other ways of being able to orient themselves in life, or I lost my eye, but look at this, I can have a bionic one now, right. How great is that, right?
Right.
I think that we don't have this kind of relationship to these immaterial parts, like robotics and things of that sort, right? Like, my computer is an extension of my brain in some sort of way at this point, right? And we don't have this kind of relationship where I think we find, oh, these pins in my elbow holding my stuff together, or if I have a bionic eye or something like that, if I buy these kinds of physical parts, people tend to be sort of less squeamish for buying and selling these. But I think, why, right? Is it organic matter? Like, if I can be like, hey, look, I can go and buy a robotic eye if I've lost my eye, versus harvesting somebody else's eye, or somebody decides to volunteer to give their eye. We're very squeamish about the second one, right? Why is that? And I think somebody like Sandel is going to point to the fact that we feel, right, this sacredness of the human being, right, in a way, right? Maybe it goes back to how we have put a limit on selling whole human beings, and we're kind of inching into, like, should we sell some parts? But a lot of countries are reluctant to sell anything. Like in Canada, right? We just started allowing plasma. Everything else, no way. Mm-hmm. Right? So we're squeamish about all these sorts of things still. And why is that? And I think it's related to why we're squeamish about selling whole humans, right? There's something about human beings that I think a lot of people don't want to carve up and sell into parts, or think that we are such creatures that can be valued in that kind of way.
It's not actually the organic-inorganic distinction here either, because I don't think we feel squeamish if you got a body part from an animal.
Right, yeah. That's true. Right? Good point. That's right. Absolutely, good
right.
point.
I mean, if somebody raised pigs in order to harvest their kidneys, and it turned out that pig kidneys could be substituted for human kidneys.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't feel any particular objection to it.
I don't either.
And right. It's being a human body part.
It's a human.
And it has something to do with it.
Yeah.
Speak to this issue, and then there's.
they are already harvesting heart valves from pigs, and then they are implanting it in humans. But I think one of the fundamental things is that if I take a body part from my fellow man, mm-hmm. I am taking something out of him. Mm-hmm. In some form, I'm diminishing him. Mm-hmm. If I take a peg leg or a bionic arm, or it's simply technology.
Yeah.
So I think there are two different stories in some way. And although they seem to be able to grow a lot of body parts in vitro now.
Yeah.
Like they have done experiments with kidney, they have done experiments with trachea, and other, and they're working on spleen and kidney, I understand.
Have they grown them and successfully transplanted them at this point?
I don't know about the transplant, mm-hmm. but they have grown some. And I was reading somewhere, don't ask me where, there is some artificial blood that it can actually put in your system, and it carries the oxygen to the, how it works exactly, I don't know.
Interesting, thank you.
Hi, 3D printers and organs.
Yes.
So make this whole conversation mm-hmm. move, because mm-hmm. of course that's what they're talking about
mm-hmm.
now.
Mm-hmm.
So we could conceivably start designing the perfect human being, and for me that's far more of an issue than, do you want to buy my kidney?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not it's more of an issue, because that's where you see things heading, right? You're thinking this parts issue is going to be a non-issue pretty soon, because it's all going to be manufactured. It's not going to be transferred.
Mm. Hello, I've got three things I wanted to respond to now.
Oh,
a bit of a backboard here. Firstly about the student signing and the rich people not signing. The rich people are probably already donated if they care to anyway. Is that right? Okay. The students, it's just useful enthusiasm. It's beautiful. Of course they do it. Okay. Secondly, I wonder if anyone has read the book Change of Heart. I can't remember the author. I've met her. She's real. It's a dancer who had a heart-lung transplant. And she was able to find the donor through dreams. And this led her to making contact with the family. So she found that her sudden dislike of whatever it was she used to like to eat before the operation, and her love of hamburgers and beer, was similar to the person who had died. So the memory was in the cells. So this is something to consider if you're going to take on someone else's parts. Okay.
Yeah. It does. It makes it. It makes it even more sort of weighty and sacred, right?
Makes what? Sorry.
It would make it even more weighty and sacred to take on somebody's parts. It's not
right,
just. It's
right,
not just tissue
right.
anymore. It's now. It's got some sort of. Soul.
Yeah, there are memories in our
in our
muscle fibers, right? And then this gentleman here took over my third thing about the pig's heart valve. Yeah, this. I wonder what effect that has. You know,
memories.
Well, there's an aspect of the market that has been. It was raised actually in your presentation, which shows how good the presentation was, but it hasn't been highlighted. If we don't think the market is completely fair, and I certainly don't think the market is, I don't think anybody thinks that.
Mm-hmm.
That applies to the recipient as well as to the donor. And if I were in parlous condition. And somebody, you know, they could find a spare part from somebody else. How would I feel about exploiting that person in perhaps putting him or her to extra risk so that I could survive. Am I justified in doing that? Mm-hmm. Or, supposing we have a body part that's available, who gets it? Mm-hmm. The rich people?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Or the people who are considered to be the most needy in some way?
Mm-hmm.
Or perhaps the people who are considered to be the most deserving? That would be a very, very tricky issue. But I do think we need to look at it from both sides. Mm-hmm. And I think that the sense of unfairness really does apply both to the recipient as well as to the donor.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you're right, and I think that in terms of who would get it first, right? If they legalized organ trade, I foresee a certain kind of two-tiered system like they have in medical care, right? If you have no money, you get in line, right? The Democrats, you know, the lines democratize everything, right? You get in line and you wait your turn. But you can skip ahead, just like you can currently, and get certain services. How do you skip ahead? How do you save your life where other people don't? You have to have money to save your life. And there's absolutely issues of fairness in there, too, or unfairness in there, yeah. And as for your other point, I think that it raises an interesting question about if you're buying from somebody and they're giving up part of themselves, right, you're putting them at risk, etc. Do you still, even if they are coming to you freely and saying, no, I'm absolutely happy to do it, right? You might feel like, oh, this is a big deal, but is it any different than if your sibling was going to give you one of their parts? Right, you'd be worried for their well-being. You'd be like, "Oh, this is a big deal. I get that, and I want you to make sure that you take care of yourself, etc." But does paying for it make it feel worse for you? That you're somehow taking advantage of them, even if they're freely saying, "No, I could use that $50,000, please and thank you. You can have my spare kidney."
Very interesting. Close enough? Everybody can hear me? Thank you very much for a very good presentation. I think the original mistake was that we made money. As in, instead of carrying pieces of silver and gold in my pocket, the first intention of printing money was, let me be the banker and give you an IOU. As in, you have a piece of gold, so I'm going to write a promissory note that says that you have a piece of gold, and then you take that piece of paper to the baker, you get a loaf of bread, and the baker then come back to me and redeem that piece of gold. That was the first intention of money. The unintended purpose of money, on the other hand, gives me unlimited power. With the right price, I can negotiate. I can obtain anything and everything I want, including somebody's life, including somebody's organs. So the question is not so much should certain body parts of the body, could it be sold, but rather, well, first of all, should a person have such power to begin with by way of having money? The question should be more properly, I think, we should ask, instead of should I be able to sell my organs, should certain things in life be simply priceless? As in, you cannot put a price on it. You cannot buy or sell it.
Yeah, and I think that there are some things that we all collectively believe that that is the case. So we talked about already how nobody's going to make an argument for why you should be able to sell yourself as a human being, right? We also do not like selling votes. Now, we might make all sorts of arguments about how that actually is happening in all sorts of different sort of complicated ways, but we forbid these things because we think that those things are so valuable as they are, that to try to sell those things is going to corrupt them. Somehow, we have made a distinction between selling all of a human being, i.e. we don't sell our children or ourselves, or we can't sell our spouse for the day or something of this sort, but parts of us seem to be okay to sell, right? And it's a sort of interesting sort of shift that we made, and I think a part of it comes from this understanding of the body as our property, and we have a fundamental right to our property and to do with it as we wish, right? And so why shouldn't we be able to sort of sell parts of it if it's necessary? But yeah. Or else we could just have a revolution and get rid of markets altogether. Congress! Yeah, all right.
Well, I'm with you on that, but you may not be with me on it, because I think markets are kind of basically necessary, but I'm not a big believer in markets, but I am a big believer in people's rights, properly so-called. So I don't think anybody ever has a right to move ahead in a line or a queue just because they have more money or more degrees or more anything. I don't think anybody's got that kind of right. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I do think we have rights over ourselves. And so far as I'm concerned, if someone wants to sell some part of themselves, then that's their right. I'm not going to approve of it. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to like it. Mm-hmm. But it's their right. And I don't think people like Sandel have any business at all getting up in a moral pulpit telling them they can't. So I want to separate sharply the right to sell from the right to buy. And I think we could take this out of play if we thought of it the way we do with the blood supply, for example. Mm-hmm. If we outlawed the purchase of body parts, mm-hmm. All right, but we allowed people to sell, if they had to, blood or other body parts to the AHS or the Red Cross or some collective agency.
Yeah, you don't exactly, I mean, that proposal doesn't exactly establish a market, right?
Which
you
proposal?
Really only got one buyer, right? The AHS. And then the AHS distributes these body parts according to some sort of principles of its own.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you don't, if it works right, which it probably won't, then wealthy people would not have an advantage in this.
That's right.
Right. So that still leaves us with people selling their body parts to the AHS, though, right? So does that bother us, right? Well, let me ask you, since you're a philosopher, does it just bother you that a person sell their some important body part like a kidney or a cornea or something?
Of course it bothers me. I mean, it bothers me that anyone would be put in that kind of situation. I mean, it would bother me if they had to do it from need, and it would bother me even more if they just did it to be playful or stupid or something. Of course that would bother me. The question isn't whether it's nice. The question is whether they have a right to do so. And what I'm protesting is Sandel getting on a moral pulpit, making all kinds of, I think, quite right moral points about decency, mm-hmm. but then using them to seal off people's rights. We've lost Martin, though. So you have to reply.
So that's fine. So in your view, you'd say that individual freedom should be the value that trumps any other thing. Even though we might individually, some of us feel squeamish about this kind of stuff, people that's a completely separate issue. It's more of an aesthetic issue in a way. That's just like, we don't like it, but ultimately it falls under this larger idea about freedom and autonomy that people should have, and that's the larger umbrella right, or the larger sort of umbrella value for you. That
That's not the only basic value, mm-hmm. but it is one basic value, yes.
Okay.
That sort of leads into a question that I think we have to face. What's so wrong with slavery after all? Am I not free to sell myself to somebody else because I don't have any means of support? My new owner is going to have to support me. Or maybe, you know, maybe I've got too many children. And somebody could use them, you know, they could work in the fields, or they could make shirts or carpets or something as slaves.
Yeah.
And yet, well, there are societies where that's acceptable. It's not a universal aversion, but in our society it's not acceptable. We've reached a position where slavery is illegal, and you can't do it anymore.
Yeah.
But what is the basis for that? I think there probably is a basis for it, but we'd have to be very conscious of that.
Yeah. Well, I think too that the kinds of examples that you raise are interesting, or what actually constitutes sort of slavery in that kind of way, right? Some people sell themselves into jobs, for example, that are absolutely horrific, right? They're not being held there by chains and whipped all day or anything of that sort, but they sell themselves into jobs because of certain coercive factors that markets bring, right? You either eat or you do this. That's not particularly a free choice in any sort of way. Mm-hmm. So whether it's you sell yourself into jobs, or certain peasants selling off their kids to go work in certain fields, you go work those jobs for me, etc., selling off your daughter or something of that sort because thank you for the dowry, this is a really nice exchange, you know, get rid of her, she's very expensive. And these are sorts of ways in which you still see this kind of implicit selling of human beings that is okay, or sometimes we justify it by cultural practices or norms, justify it in terms of people do what they have to do in impoverished situations, and isn't that sad? Ideally, I think a lot of people think still that these things shouldn't be happening, right? Still, and I don't know. What's the ultimate philosophical ground for not enslaving yourself? I mean, somebody like Kant, right? Immanuel Kant, a philosopher, thinks that as a rational being, that rationality gives you freedom and autonomy, and that is the most important thing that you need to protect. It would be perverse to essentially give up the one sort of most important value, right? It just doesn't make any sort of rational sense.
But then why isn't Kant sort of opposed to selling what Marx called wage slavery? I mean, why isn't he opposed to my saying, okay, for 8 hours of the day, you can tell me what to do, and I'll do it.
Because he had a very unsubtle idea about what freedom consists of. I think. I think Kant's notion of autonomy is so sort of strict, right? I don't think he had a good sense of coercive social forces in that way. It's a too basic understanding of autonomy, I think.
Okay. Marriage.
Marriage.
Yes.
Marriage.
I know nothing
anybody
about
heard,
it.
Anybody heard of a nuptial agreement?
Prenuptial.
What we're going to do with the assets if we don't get along?
Yeah.
Anybody heard of alimony payments?
Yep.
Women have been either forced into, put themselves up for, or just blithely gone into marriage throughout history. Now, if that is not a form of sales, I don't know what is in this. And it's happening now still, all the time. And we do sell our children. Let's look at hockey. Let's look at hockey and football. How many parents out there say, oh my God, he's making how much money? You're going to start training right now, buddy. Mm-hmm. They go out and they buy all the equipment. They haul their kids off at 6 in the morning. And they'll tell you it's for fun, but if any parent has been around a hockey rink at 5:36 in the morning, while Junior is, if they're like one of mine was, sitting there making snow angels on the ice, they're sitting there, the money, the dollar signs are calculating. Oh my God, I'm going to make millions out of this kid, and he'll support me when I'm old. Is happening in this day and age all the time. Yeah. We have our stars out there. What is that young lady's name? Billy Ray Cyrus' daughter.
How much
money is she making out there on TV every time she goes? And we're buying it, we're buying her, and we're selling it to our children. Mm-hmm. We are putting up the human for sale every single second of the day. We decry child slavery. Mm-hmm. We decry prostitution. Mm-hmm. But let's be honest, we're doing it every day under different guise.
Yes, the question I had is, it flows from recognizing that society deals with a lot of human behaviors and substances that cause a lot of harm, and often decides to try to ban these bad behaviors. I can list the consumption of alcohol, tobacco, drugs, abortions, prostitution, gambling, and at times we have tried to ban them, mm-hmm. and we ended up shoving them underground with horrible consequences, and then eventually, at least in some cases, society decides the damage being done by not legislating, like decriminalizing, legislating, controlling, and so on. The damage that's done by following that course sometimes is far worse than recognizing these ancient behaviors, while not desirable in themselves, but by legislating, decriminalizing, licensing, getting these things out of the hands of criminal elements, perhaps it's a better policy. And so the question I'm left with is, how does society make that decision as to when, by refusing to decriminalize and legislate, when the damage is going to be greater than if you legalize it and control it?
Right. I think that's kind of a complicated issue, and we talked about this idea about this minimization of harms as part of that utilitarian reasoning, right? Because the black markets that are created, safety issues, unregulated, people don't get proper care, all these kinds of things. And that's a genuine sort of concern for people and a reason to actually legalize these kinds of things. I think what's holding people back isn't necessarily this, when it comes to legalizing the organ trade or something like that. I don't think people are really held back so much by the fact that, oh, you know, what's happening in China, prisoners' organs are being harvested, like, for a country that doesn't have any formal organ donation process, because the body's sacred and you're not supposed to do that. They do more organ transplants there than any country their size, right? And prisoners are disappearing all the time, etc. And so we have these kinds of things that are happening, and people say that the black market trade in these sorts of things is actually pretty, not that big, but they're happening. But I'm not sure whether the response, whether there's hesitation because it's not bad enough, right? Because there's hesitation about just commodifying and selling all kinds of body parts that there's sort of no real sort of genuine issue with, right? Like selling your sperm in Canada or these sorts of things. So I think that there's a separate issue there, that I don't know whether it's a matter of waiting until things get bad enough. I think that those harms that are caused because the black markets and the practices that develop therein is something that is considered and is a reason why people are like, we should legalize this, right? Some sort of nice international body to legalize and structure this, standards, all of those wonderful things that you mentioned. But I don't know whether that would be the only reason because of what we have seen with other body parts. We're still reluctant for issues about, I think, this kind of intrinsic value of a human being that we don't want to sort of let go of. Yeah, good question.
Just a brief mention, if anyone wants to read a novel about this topic, it's by Harold Schreier, and it's part of the Cooperman Chronicles. He's a Canadian private investigator, but he goes to the States to investigate this issue with an immigrant doctor. And it's talking about what can happen in although with all of the things supposedly in place. So it's quite interesting. If anybody's interested, it would be worth it to give a read. Not bad writing either.
I'd love for you to answer that lady's question or comments rather about the challenge she threw out to all of us was who's going to cast the first stone. You know, we need to look at ourselves as to what's happening up here in other ways rather than, you know, accuse other countries of doing.
Right.
But then my question after that is, I'd like to go back to the instance you gave of two companies which sell blood plasma. Founded in Canada now,
yeah.
after finding out that all of it was coming from the States. We, each of us, all of us, live in institutions, whether it's government, market, you know, whatever you call it. We're part of institutions. Corporations are part of the same environment. So which corporation was pushing to get those two established in Canada?
I don't know.
I think that would be a good question to ask because
so far,
you know, We concentrate on the individual, but I think corporations are a huge part of the whole picture.
Right, and I think that I didn't sort of do enough research on this, and if anybody knows what's happening with respect to these two new sort of plasma institutes, but I think a real genuine case can be made for the fact that they're in place not to in any sort of way ensure lots of good supply to Canadian Blood Bank, right? Because they can go absolutely just and buy the plasma straight from the States if that's what they wanted to do. They've sort of positioned themselves as this kind of middleman now that's going to make money off of doing this sort of transfer, right? And so you have this idea, I think, of corporatization coming in there as well, right? It's good. It's a for-profit system. So it's not just a matter of collecting this stuff and out of the goodness they're just going to help transfer. And I think that that's sort of an important issue. And as for, you wanted me to comment on her remarks about how we are in our own way enslaving our children and all of these kinds of things. And I think... I haven't thought about this, and I'm thinking about this as I'm speaking right now. I think that there is a sense when you're talking about parents or anything of that sort, we kind of allow parents to exert coercive practices on children, right? Your child probably wants to stay up and eat cake and stay up until 6 o'clock in the morning watching cartoons, but we say, no, go to bed, right? And so we exert coercive practices on children all the time, and a lot of times parents, I think, right? We don't think of it as sort of creating sort of enslavement or banking on sort of the future, but a lot of parents invest in their children's future, right? Whether it's investing in their education, whether it's, hey, I'm going to send you to dance lessons because you really like that, maybe you'll make it on stage one day, or hockey or something of this sort. People invest in their children's future. Now, if you start to sort of prohibit that kind of behavior, right? You start to tell parents how they can raise their own children, which I think people don't want to enter that sort of territory, right? So when we talk about, so we can make moral judgments about how kind of perverse it is in a sort of way, but I think we want to be careful about using this language of we are that enslaving them, right? I think we want to sort of keep that kind of language quite sacred for when that stuff is actually going on, when we are actually literally buying and selling human beings. So maybe we want to keep that language quite sacred for when that's going on, but that doesn't mean that we can't look at those kinds of practices that parents engage in and realize that sometimes parents do things because they're hoping to get some sort of utilitarian value. Maybe their kid will, you know, make it to the NHL and they can live, you know, happy for the rest of their lives. Some parents, though, just want to invest in their child's future in some sort of way, whether it's, I'm going to send you to the best university money can buy, because I think that that's really important. And whether we want, we can make certain kinds of comments about that, but I think it's going to be dangerous territory to tell parents that there are proper and appropriate ways that they must raise their children according to. Does that answer your question? Yes and no, okay.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it does, but I also start again the legal territory as to what the government, you know, which is owned by people, to do or not do. I mean, how did we get to that state? It's, for example, use the word squeamish quite often.
Yeah.
You know, how did we get to the stage where we talk about something being squeamish rather than saying, as another gentleman put it in the back there, it's sacred or it shouldn't be done?
It's sacred.
You know, so
yeah.
Over time, things have changed. And how did we come to this position where we can now say it's okay to do this? It's,
yes.
For example, you know, we live next to a country where I think, you know, we all know about the 1% and the 99% of the corporations own everything.
Yes.
So now, you know, to what extent are we going to allow ourselves, and maybe all of us, maybe not, you know,
yes.
We'll allow ourselves to become more quote-unquote American in that sense, you know?
Absolutely.
So, you know, these morality as usual or ethics or whatever, you know, it's always moving.
Yeah.
You know, the targets are always moving.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's a question of at what point do you draw a line, or at what point do we come back, or what is important. Is, for example, when David, when he began, he was talking about theology and how to bring back certain kinds of language,
yeah,
into discussion.
Mm-hmm.
Or when you use the word investment in your children.
Yeah.
I mean, that comes from a market.
It's market language.
It's the capitalist,
mm-hmm,
value.
Yeah.
You know, did people talk about investment, say, 100 years ago in their children? Maybe,
yeah,
not. You know?
Yeah.
It was just a question of the language being used.
Yeah, sure. And I think, I mean, and that's those kinds of questions that you're asking are the same sorts of points that Sandel is making, right? When he's like, even like 30 years from now or 30 years earlier, you couldn't have anticipated that we would have commodified and the kinds of things that we buy and sell. You can sell your virginity online. You can sell your... you can sell, you know, your plasma. You can sell absolutely anything. And this question is anything absolutely sacred? Now, Sandel doesn't he doesn't use the word sacred quite regularly, but he comes up with it once in a while, right? In terms of trying to tease out what is it that's giving us this kind of qualm, right? Why do we feel wrong about it, right? Is there something genuinely sacred and intrinsically valuable about certain things that shouldn't be commodified that we are commodifying? And it's been a quick and tragic and I think the quickness of it, slippery slope, as we've found a way to pretty much be able to buy and sell anything you want. And no one has paused to say, what are the limits? Have we gone too far? And which is his point in the book, right? It's like we've the markets have surpassed our moral conversations about these things. Sure.
I think one point,
yeah,
sorry.
Yeah.
I appreciate you quoting Sandel, but like Dawn at the back there, I seem to have an aversion to him as well.
Yeah,
you
sure.
You know, it's like, for example, when we saw a video of his 4 weeks ago,
okay,
one of the examples he gave was the fact that there are so many mercenaries,
yeah,
in Iraq and et cetera, et cetera. Everywhere where the U.S. is going to war, there are so many more mercenaries as opposed to regular government soldiers.
Yeah.
Well, who made that possible? You know, the question to ask is, was it just the market? It wasn't a market that made it possible. It was people who made it possible. People who want, who are interested in nothing but money.
But profits.
Yeah. So, you know, and government is part of it. So, you know, it's important to question that kind of thing as well. It's not just about the individual, but it's about the larger things as well. Because we all live in institutions, whether they're corporations or banks or government or market or whatever. You know?
Absolutely.
So I think it's important to question that, and important to question the class as well that underlies all this.
Absolutely. I don't think anytime you talk about markets, you can leave out the notion that there are extremely powerful bodies in the market, the corporations, right? They have more power than political actors these days. Mm-hmm. And so I think when you talk about markets, the markets do this or they distribute goods. That's not to say that, oh, these are just sort of nice ways of transferring sorts of goods and should be able to sort of buy and sell, but all of these things are part and parcel of it. The corporations that have that enormous amount of influence, and they have their tentacles politically, sort of embedded politically as well, right? They have an enormous amount of power. What do you do about those situations?
Now
Revolution.
I've got three people. but I want to take who is speaking to this topic or wants to continue with this topic? Because I'll let them go first. You do?
You partly answer the question. I really strongly objected to investment in children. I think it doesn't make any sense to look at children as an investment. Once you realize that, then we can maybe step back and take a good look and say, what's wrong with our society if we decide to invest in children?
And I'm not sure whether we're talking about the same word invest when we use that language. And it is. It's a market word, invest. And when I think about invest, it's kind of like how when you emotionally invest in somebody, right? Rather than I'm investing in you so you're going to be rich and you can take care of me and buy me yachts when I'm older. That's not the kind of idea of invest that I was using. I was using that parents invest in their children a lot of times for enrichment, right? They want their children to have experiences, so they send them to ballet without any hope that they're going to actually be a ballerina because they're horrible at it. Or they send them to certain other kinds of lessons. They invest in a university education for the child's enrichment that they will have a fine life. So that's what I was talking about. What I meant, parents invest in children.
Yeah, but I think the point is that the word invest
really
seems inappropriate.
I know. Talking about markets, I should have been more careful.
Yeah. Well, it's hard to think of another word.
What's another word for that?
Provide
for children. Provide enrichments for their children.
Help grow
their children in these sorts of ways.
Nurture.
Yeah.
Nurture.
That just sounds like you're giving them hugs and giving them, like, porridge in the morning and, like, good meals.
See? The market has devalued a word again.
So many points. A lot of them about markets. Market, among the things you need for a market is communications, so the buyer and the seller can talk to each other. And one of the changes that's happened in the last while is the ability to talk to somebody around the world and with translation software and such to have them understand you, and it exposes you to people who have a different idea what's commodities, what's for sale, what they're squeamish about. Mm-hmm. But the ability to talk to between buyers and sellers, I think, an important part of markets, and that's a big change in the last while. Mm-hmm. Another aspect of markets is the currency or the consideration. Well, there are other considerations than just money. Investment, maybe your kid will buy you a yacht, or maybe you just like seeing them take their first step, their first trip on skates, and you get the emotional payoff. And somebody who, a family member who gives you an organ gets an emotional payoff.
Can't
be measured in money. And Alice Munro could write a book full of short stories on such emotional payoffs. You spoke earlier about something that markets should stick to what markets are good at, and there should be other systems like collective and individual goodwill for handling other aspects of our
That wasn't my view, that was somebody else's.
Well, it was brought up. But markets, the people who like markets tend to want to expand to fill everything they can. Your body, if you don't own it and therefore can't sell pieces of it, well, who does? Because markets like to know who owns things. Corporate slavery, if you've taken the corporate cell phone that's always on, tell me who's the corporate slave. As to sacred language, putting Omar Khadr and the words war crimes in the same sentence sounds like an abuse of sacred language to me. And yeah, that's about everything I've written down here. Thank you.
Alrighty.
Okay, just to, my bad. I didn't mean to, as someone said, bring this cafe down into the mud. But I was being a little bit tongue-in-cheek with regard to children. And I would like everyone to understand that while it may seem on the surface, you know, we're not doing this, you were saying we don't want to start telling parents how to do things. Well, we do. I tell you, you walk into any school nowadays, teacher doesn't like you, whoever doesn't like you, they're going to take you on. They don't like what you're doing. It doesn't matter whether you believe that you're morally right, ethically right, or just right. They will take you on. So you better believe that Big Brother is there watching you in a big way. Schools have gotten to that point now. You go into any institution now, you walk down the street, you're being watched. Where am I going with this? There is an insidious vein, I believe, out there that is taking away our rights. And it's happening at a very fast rate. It's taking away our rights as parents, right, as individuals. Selling body parts, my personal view is, as I said earlier, 3D is going to just not be an issue anymore. To me, what's more important is the fact that we're shipping asbestos to different parts of the world, Sri Lanka, where it's being used in the tiles, dropping down, so we're literally putting poison into people's homes. They're going to die, so perhaps their body parts will end up on the market. Who knows? We have thousands and thousands of people throughout the world that are starving to death, and there's been so many issues brought up where people who are underfed don't think properly. If you're starving, your brain isn't being fed. You're not getting nutrition. Well, here we go again. We're enslaving, or have the potential to enslave whole societies through our own greed. So there's this insidious vein that the wealthy population will eventually take over the poor, and that we're going to enslave them. We're going to use them. That's all.
So, I mean, I think that absolutely that there's capitalism creates an oppressive structure, and there's something sort of insidious that's happening there. And I'm just curious about when you made the sort of the comment that we're being watched, we must stand up for our very sort of individual rights and freedoms where we can, right? Because they're being slowly sort of eroded away, right? And power sort of being taken from us. And say 3D printers are 50 years down the line from being able to actually produce organs that we can make and put into our bodies or whatever. Do you then feel, is your sort of view that we should, therefore, it's really important for us to be able to actually sell our organs, that it is our fundamental right to be able to do with our body as I wish, on those sorts of grounds where you said we need to stand up, right? And all these oppressive structures that are telling us, don't do this, don't do this, this is bad, this is immoral, don't do this, that they're trying to sort of, you know, shape us into certain sets of morals rather than allowing us to sort of be free. And if I want to do this with my body, I ought to. I'm just curious about your thoughts on that.
Yeah, are you sort of libertarian on this this business?
Imagine 3D printer. We are having a big debate about this thing. We're going to decide this on the weekend. 3D printers are functional 50 years down the line. What do you think we should do in this circumstance? I'm not sure.
I think that what's going to happen is we're going to start reproducing organs at such a rate it won't be an issue anymore. The only issue I could possibly think there is people wanting to have human body parts, and then who cares? You sell your body part and then get a 3D one.
So you're okay with that? So you want to run a sort of strict libertarian sort of argument that you're kind of like, it's my body, it's our bodies, right? We should be able to buy and sell these parts if we want to.
At that point, because then organs are going to be replicated at such a rate it won't matter anymore.
Right now?
Yeah. That's a tough one. I mean, that's why we're here discussing it. Do I think that everybody should go out and say, okay,
imagine
I want to
there's
sell
no
this?
Future solution. There's no future solution that we're hoping for. It's just what we have right now. What kind of system should we be...
For myself personally?
Yeah.
No. But having said that, you have to draw some lines, right?
No, in terms of we shouldn't sell them?
No, we're either going to say, yes, we can sell everything, or no, we're not selling anything.
Yes.
And what comes to mind is sperm. Now, you had said in the States they sell sperm, in Canada we don't. So what about someone who willingly gets pregnant, wants an abortion, yet they're using the man's sperm? So maybe she should pay him. Sperm. I don't know if I can explain that appropriately.
Yeah, I'm sort of still trying to follow that.
Me too.
We can't have it all ways, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, right. I don't think that is sort of an option, right? And I was just sort of asking you, do you want to maintain sort of a strict libertarian ground where it's like, yes, we should all have a right to sell any body part we want to because it's ours. Because you kind of gave me a sense of giving a bit of a libertarian feel that, you know, our rights and freedoms are sort of the most important thing. But I wasn't quite sure what your conclusion would be with respect to organs today, given that if we imagine there's no solution.
Okay, for the purpose of this discussion, I'll say yes. We should be able
sell,
to.
Sell, buy and sell, yeah.
And, you know, when you separate something totally from all religious strictures, we tend to put all kinds of fancy things around this.
Yeah.
If I want to go sell my heart to somebody and get a pig's heart put into place,
you should be able to.
I should be able to.
Yeah. And a lot of people would argue that too. I think I've only looked at a few sort of public opinion polls, and I think that there's a few that there are more in favor of we should be able to sell them. Like it's almost like 50-50, the ones that I saw, but it's just marginally in favor of people think we should sell them or be allowed to.
This may be slightly off, but the lady was talking of the rights of parents.
Yeah.
And I would like somebody to explain to me what are the rights of parents versus, for example, what does society expect from the future generation.
Yeah.
Next question is, how many of us would like to live to 150, 200, 300, whatever the limit is? In other words, having spare part, does that mean that we're going to live for a long time? Or does it mean that we're going to have a shorter life, healthier? Or what are the choices?
Let me say something about your last question first. I mean, there's all sorts of questions, I think, about prolonging life just for the sake of prolonging life, right? And I think that those kinds of questions do come into play when you're talking about organs that can save lives and things of that sort. But I think even if you're like, that's a whole question. But in terms of, there's a question about prolonging life and what's suitable or not. I think that those questions do come into play, but I think that whether or not we should sell body parts is still going to be a question. Even if we said, look, right, only organ transfers for people under the age of 18 or something of this sort. Even if we said that, we'd still have to deal with this ethical question about whether we should be selling body parts, right? So I think how long we should prolong life is another question, and I think those quality of life issues come into deciding who's on waiting lists and who gets it next and all that kind of stuff, for sure. But I think that the moral and ethical question comes up regardless of, even if we said after 18, no one gets an organ. You still have to ask, should we be buying and selling them, I think. Why should we preserve life at all? I'm going to claim self-evident truth. No, I don't. I don't know how to begin or how to tackle that. I think we should. And
why?
I'm not sure what kind of justification to give you for why we should preserve life.
Wait a minute. I want to...
Martin wants to do it instead.
There's a distinction to be made here between preserving life and extending it.
Yes.
Because the extending life means, look, most people now live to my age. And, should we spend much time and resources, trying to get people to live to 80 and 85, 90, all this kind of business. I see quite a bit of sense in the position that, no, a waste of time. If you mean preserving life, then you're talking about, young people, middle-aged people who have had accidents. Yeah. You run out and you try to keep them alive.
And
I would say that even with old people, you try to keep them alive. But that's different. You see, there's a distinction there.
But his question that I was trying to answer was, he asked, why should we save life at all? Not preserve, why, right? Am I correct? Why should we save life at all? And I said self-evident truth, and then I'm Martin. You answer it for me.
No, actually two questions somewhere.
Okay.
Why should we repair life, if you want, and why should we extend life?
Repair life?
Well, in the sense, somebody's in an accident.
Okay. Oh, that's what you meant, but okay.
And also, should we extend?
Yeah.
All right.
I'm
just happy with the questions.
Yeah, right. And as I say, I think the two questions shouldn't be confused. I agree with you that I don't know. It's self-evident. All that I would say is I bet there's not a single person in this room who would question, suppose somebody suddenly had a heart attack in this room, right? And somebody here is a doctor with a defibrillator or whatever it is. And somebody asks the question, well, should we try to save this person? I think all of us would just, why do you even ask that question? It's ridiculous, right? But on the other hand, if you start talking about special drugs that will keep people my age going even after their brain is giving out and everything like that. Then of course there's a question to be dealt with. And I think most of us, is there anybody who would disagree with that? I mean, you do. I knew it. I knew there'd be one.
Okay, are we going to get very personal here? 4 years ago, I had a stroke. They left me paralyzed on half of the body. Personally, I don't think it was worth trying to come back. Was a hell of a job, and it's still going on. And I don't see a horizon.
I see.
It's going to be a downhill all the way. And my joke is, the next stroke, I hope is a good one, so I don't have to come back.
Interesting. Would you feel the same way? Are you making that judgment now because you're like, this was really the recovery was really hard, and the struggles that followed really sort of weren't worth the life that you're weighing it in terms of sort of cost benefit to yourself.
No cost benefit.
Okay.
It's just a question. My way of looking at it, I've had a very good run.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's almost time to pack it in. Yeah. Right. Why should I extend my life at, say, at the expense or energy invested in the new generation? Why should I invest in keeping me alive? I mean, I fought, you know, like, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
They kept telling me how fantastically well I was doing, just because I wanted to walk again, all right? But the point is it really worth doing when you know that your sunset is coming and the sun is going down? Doesn't matter what you do. Okay?
That's an existential question. It really is. Yeah, it's a, it's an existential question that I would hesitate to even give any sort of ethical answer to that.
Does existential just mean difficult here?
No, something to do with personal individual meaning, I think, but and with difficulties. But yeah, thanks for sharing them.
I have a friend who knows a couple really well. She said they were getting on the plane, and if it hadn't been that they were getting on a plane, he wouldn't have been brought back. Like, there wouldn't have been the defibrillator right there. And the leftovers of this experience, she's very passionate about it, wasn't worth it. It's not worth it to him. He can't do any of his life things that he always did. It's not worth it to his spouse, who was in the actually going to leave him. They were breaking off their relationship, and then now, so she said, this is wrong. Why do we bring people back? What are we doing? And I thought, wow, I never, you know, I hadn't thought of that, but it is a good question.
Yeah, and I don't, I mean, I think people like advocating for life just for the sake of life, I think that that's a small proportion of the population, but I think there's a tendency to now think about actual quality of life, right? I.e., if a transplant is going to allow me to not to be hooked up to a dialysis machine all the time, that I can actually go and travel someplace, that I can go to work, that I can go see my friends, and that I now have certain kinds of freedoms and quality of life that I didn't have, certain procedures are really sort of useful, right? Or certain kinds of medications, right? If I have some disease and they can cut it out and I carry on to live a happy life, these are all conditional about a quality of life. If it's simply about just living in a degraded state, I think very few people are going to, I think few people, and I could be wrong, want to still argue that that should happen, that people should be forced to live in a degraded state where they're not getting any meaning or satisfaction anymore from life, but they're just alive.
Mm-hmm. I'm sort of going to go to a different point away from this, the more general issue, and not that it's not interesting or important.
Don't you want to talk about death?
So earlier on, Martin had made the point, like the point contra Marx, about what's the difference wage slavery. And I kind of want to get to the point of the analog between the way we rent certain traits and selling body parts.
Yeah.
For example, somebody will put on their resume, I'm trustworthy, I'm organized. So essentially, you're renting that trait. And for me, that's much more corrupting. The fact that I'm being sold, it's kind of a non-sexual prostitution, you know, that process of applying to a job. I think that is fundamentally more problematic, or that's the root of the issue. And this bit about bodies is just more of a side effect of the process of commodification. And to say that we can have this strict separation between capitalism and markets as an economic system and a non-capitalist, non-market-oriented morality seems to me like that's very, I don't think that Sandel is quite right there, and there's going to, like, you can stay, but just kind of stand your ground and say, we're going to try to prevent markets from entering into this force, and there are possibilities for political decisions to be made. Mm-hmm. But there is always this going to be this tendency. You can even look at it in terms of some norms that we don't see as being involved in market. The idea of the good provider was something that arose from a changeover from a very aristocratic honor ethic, this mm-hmm. idea of the feminization of virtue, that you should be a good provider.
Right. Right. I was interested, too. I thought the way that you were going to go was going to be how we sell our various sorts of labors or skills or capacities. But you went to something even more specific. You're like, that I'm selling certain kinds of character traits, like well-organized and something of that sort. Now, do you mean to sort of marry those two things together, or are you keeping them separate? The idea of we engage in these kind of relationships where we sell ourselves to various companies and say, here, take the products of my labor, give me a little bit, I'll keep coming back, blah. Or are you talking about character traits specifically in a unique way?
I think that character traits bring in a whole new level. I think they are tied together. Like,
okay.
There's certain kinds of jobs where you can, like, get away and say, okay, I can just build this thing for you, and then you don't need to. But when you're working in a team situation,
right,
and you're often working and you're selling, things are probably more, I consider certain traits about myself that you might put on a resume, more essential to me than one of my kidneys. So that might be something that we should be a little more worried about.
I see.
Even though that the selling body parts and buying body parts is problematic in certain
yes.
ways.
Yes. Okay. Interesting. And so how do you? I guess my question is, how do you? If you think of your traits and if you think of your personality as something intrinsic to you, right? Unless you're like, I'm selling these qualities that I don't really have, because the argument is about sort of pretense, or that you have to sort of engage in some sort of inauthentic sort of act while you're at work or whatever. But if you're talking about real genuine character traits that you have, I don't know what other option is, what other option you have aside from them going with you mm-hmm. to whatever mm-hmm. employment that you're doing.
Well, it's a general problem for all. Once we have any sort of market-based economy, and like, there's no way, I wouldn't be able to say within the context of a market economy how we could solve this. I don't have a particular solution.
Revolution.
But we probably should be mindful that this exists, and I guess not sort of have this kind of separation that it's so bad that we're having to sell this part of ourselves without even realizing
right.
what we're actually doing.
Right, right. Yeah, and I take your larger point, and I think it's an important one, right? That it's not like, oh, this is getting crazy. We're selling our body parts. It was crazy way before that, right? It was crazy. We were marketized already in certain sorts of ways. Whether we're forced to sell our labor, I mean, people make these kinds of comments when you're talking about, you know, in my class when we're doing Marx. We talk about this idea of, does anybody ever dream of working at the Golden Arches or being a Subway sandwich artist or something of this sort? People don't usually enter those kinds of labors with this, you know, yes, they filled out those applications and they go there and they do all that kind of stuff, but in a way you are selling yourself for food, rent, those kinds of things, in a way that people say is quite coercive.
I think we're getting into an area that we will be discussing more, not next time, but I think it's the time after that, when the whole subject of prostitution comes up, that it's going to be wider than what we normally think of as prostitution. It's this whole business of selling oneself, right? I mean, that sort of language that is used very frequently. You've got to learn to sell yourself, right? Right. Okay, so thank you very much for coming. And let's thank Elizabeth for her.